Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. On the afternoon of June 17th, Tanglewood in Lenox, Massachusetts, will be the latest stop for two musical legends who only recently, finally, started working together. Last fall, Judy Collins and Stephen Stills, whose fiery relationship in the 1960s led to the classic CSN song Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, came together for a new album, Everybody Knows. The title comes from a Leonard Cohen song the pair recorded for the album. Their concert begins at 2:30 on June 17th. I spoke with Judy Collins about the album, Leonard Cohen's legacy, and working with Stephen Stills in September. Why did you and Stephen want to work together now?
Well, we've talked about this for a number of years and thought that it would someday be a good idea, and then someday is here. So someday came sooner than expected. But we have worked on the idea of what the songs would be that we do, and finally we got the ability to find a place in our schedules where we could both make the record and also have a big tour that would be fun. And I'm having a ball, I must say.
Was there any worry on your part that the idea of you two working together might be better than it in practice?
Well, I think we had the idea that something would happen that was exciting and fun, and that we would, if we could survive the tour, it probably would be very good.
What do you mean by survive the tour? Getting along with each other or just being on the road?
Oh, no, not getting along. We've always gotten along. That's why probably we got to this point where we decided to do this. We've always been friends. The rough patch happened during the affair, I guess. And then after that, it's been smooth sailing because we pretty much agree on everything, politics and music and life in general. So we've had a wonderful friendship, and I guess that this very much celebrates a friendship that's been weathered over 50 years and has survived, and that we all both have something to say and a lot of music to express it with.
How did the two of you first meet?
We met, his memory of it is slightly different than mine, because I don't remember being at the Whiskey A Go-Go when Eric Clapton was performing, and I was sitting with my producer, with David Anderle, and it was in Hollywood, of course, in Beverly Hills, and I was sitting there, and he was at another table. Of course, he had just broken up Buffalo Springfield, so he was sort of in a hiatus, but he was a big fan. I didn't know this until very much recently. He was a big fan before we met. He had been listening to my records when he was a child, really. And, you know, he's 7 years younger than I, so it's when you're that age, it's a big difference. But he came over to me, according to him, and kissed my hand. And I made some comment about, oh, younger men, something like that. And then David Anderle said to me later on, he said, you know, this is the guy that I want to come and join us in the studio because he's a wonderful guitarist and he'll be a great addition to our band. So he came on board to this amazing group that David had put together for my record, which turned out to be called Who Knows Where the Time Goes. And he came into a band that included James Burton and Van Dyke Parks and Chris Etheridge. And just a stellar group of performers. And he came into the room and started playing, and I just, you know, I was really smitten. He's such a genius, and he got to me right away. And then, of course, we had an affair that resulted in Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, if nothing else.
So you mentioned that the two of you agree on music and agree on politics and obviously had this chemistry. So how come it didn't work out ultimately?
Oh, well, we were both young and ambitious and had our own routes to go. I lived on the East Coast. He lived on the West Coast. I lived in New York. I was in therapy. He didn't like either one particularly. So I think, you know, my life was very focused on my career, on studying, on being you know, as close as possible to my therapist. You know, it was a different thing, and I did not want to live in L.A. That's certainly true. That was certainly a part of it, and I didn't want to be a part of that scene. So it was I think a mutually, although it was bumpy because when he played me Sweet Julie Blue Eyes, he came to a hotel in Santa Monica and played me Sweet Judy Boys, and it was just so beautiful. And I said, well, it is a gorgeous song, but it's not going to get me back. But on the other hand, we stayed friends. You know, we talked, we visited, we somehow kept what was best, I think, about. He always says, you know, our friendship survived because we married other people, which I think is true.
You know, you've gone on with your lives, you've had your own families, and yet this kind of tumultuous period became an iconic song. Is it weird to have that part of your life be a public part of, you know, radio history and things like that? It's a part of the fabric.
Well, it's very exciting. I mean, first of all, that is, I think, the song of the generation about romance and idealism. On a personal level, and of course he's written very many songs, as I have, about the political issues. So it's wonderful. You know, I was as much a fan of CSNN as anybody else, and I just think he's a genius anyway, and he's still the playing. You know, I can't get over being the girl singer and guitar player in a rock and roll band with Stephen Stills. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
Has politics come into your performances on this tour at all?
Oh, well, everybody knows what they're coming to see, first of all. And we do some material that makes political sense and social sense. And I think people are, I think, revived and encouraged to resist and to do what they can to make a difference. That's all I feel. You know, I feel that music, the point of going out and doing this is that people get a chance to sit out in the audience and think. They listen, of course, but they're thinking. They're thinking about their lives, about what their lives are like, how they could make them better, as we all do when we go to hear a performance. You know, we're caught with our own conscience. And I like to think that we're making a difference because we give a chance for people to actually focus on the positive and figure out how they're going to make the world a better place. I look at it that way.
You just said a moment ago that everybody knows what they're coming to hear, and that's actually the name of the album that the two of you have worked on. You are credited with really helping bring Leonard Cohen's songs to the masses very early on, and I'm just wondering why you wanted to do that song on this record, but also name the record Everybody Knows.
Because of what's happened in the world, and because we both agree, Stephen and I, that Leonard was my friend for 50 years, and I recorded the first of his songs and continued to record him all through his life and the rest of his life and my life. And when he died the morning of the election. And Stephen and I agreed that that was a smart thing to do. If he was going to die, he might as well have chosen that day. And his last album, of course, was called You Want It Darker, and boy, are we getting it darker. So after his death, a few days after his death, I said to myself, I have to start singing Everybody Knows, because it's, although it comes from, I think, I'm Your Man, 1986 album, I think,
yeah,
of Leonard's. And I had known, in fact, Leonard called me and read me many of the verses when he was writing that song. And I never did record it, and I started to do it in concert, and I sent a little, in November, I sent Stephen a live recording from a rehearsal that we were doing, and I said, I think we should put this on the album. We had started to collect the things we thought we would record, and he said, I love it, we'll have to do it. So that's why we're doing it, because it brings the past and the present into focus, and of course, because it's Leonard, I love that we're singing something in his writing voice and his musical voice. It adds a lot to our show, I think. And we have to keep remembering that Leonard was always on the cutting edge. He always saw around the corners. He always knew things for what they were, and he always represented the truth.
With the fingers crossed, everybody knows that the war is over. Everybody knows that the good guy's lost. Everybody knows that the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich. it goes, everybody knows.
Do you miss him a lot?
I miss him like mad.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very special person in my life.
Him being gone, has it made hearing his songs and doing his songs mean something different to you?
Well, people respond to music in different ways. I've always been enchanted with his work, and now I'm getting a chance because I'm working on a project that will be a Leonard Cohen album. And I'm now getting a chance to approach and listen to and work on some of the recent songs, some of the ones that I didn't ever have a chance to look into. And it's a rich, rich resource of incredibly interesting and beautiful music. So, you know, that's where my pleasure comes from, is working on my own music and listening to and recording those songs that I fall in love with of other artists. And Leonard's always been primary artist in my life. You know, I discovered him, or he discovered me. Yes. We did things for each other that were extraordinary. He introduced me to his best friends, and I introduced him to mine. And I pushed him on stage in 66 or 67. Maybe it was the spring of 67, and made him sing in public. And he did not sing in public. He swore that he never would. And I forced him on stage, and it changed his life. He decided that he would start singing his own songs, which he did, which we know has been historic in terms of what he's been able to do as a performer, and then reemerge after a hiatus of about 15 years and come back with a Grand Slam finish, because, you know, he had a big, big, big third act, they would say. And so he's been a part of my life. Then he asked me in 1967, he said, well, it's important that you're singing all my songs and making me famous. His words, by the way. But he said, what I don't understand is why you're not writing your own songs, which I'd never written a song in my life. Everybody around me was a singer-songwriter, but I didn't write songs. And so I went home to my apartment in New York and sat down at my Steinway, because I had started playing again after a couple years where I didn't. And I wrote Since You've Asked, and that was my first self-penned song, and I've been writing ever since. And my last album, the most recent Grammy nomination, was an album that I co-wrote with Ari Hest, called Silver Skies Blue, which was my first Grammy nomination in 40 years and his first of any. So he introduced me to my own self as a writer. And, you know, it's interesting. I didn't have to go into therapy to do that. I didn't have to go to a huge seminar. I just sat down and started. And he set the wheels rolling. And I major songwriting is occurring even now. I have one of my new songs on the Everybody Knows album. I played it for him, and he said, oh, I love that. We have to do that. It's called River of Gold. So it's helped me to stay sane, actually, being able to write songs, and helped me to proliferate my feelings about life in general, politics, love, sorrow, loss, celebration, all those things.
Well, I just have one more quick question for you, and then we will hear River of Gold before segment ends. Famously, Stephen Stills gave you this Martin guitar after playing the suite for you the first time, and I'm just wondering if you play that in this concert tour at all.
I don't. It lives at home, and it's a beautiful guitar. I sent it out to Martin Guitar to clean it up and freshen it up, and they did the repairs, but they also, Dick Boak said to me, he's the guy who has done for so many years the signature guitars for everybody in the business, you know, me and Joan Baez and Willie Nelson and Stephen Stills and me. And then he said, I want to, if you don't mind, I'd like to put it in the Martin exhibit at the Martin Company down in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And I said, sure. You know, so it's been down there for 2 or 3 years. And I just got it back, and maybe it'll make an appearance in one of these coming. But what I do have is the 12-string that Martin built for me. It's a signature Judy Collins 12-string Martin. I think it's a D40. Fantastic guitar. And I went to Martin, well, I've had a long relationship with Martin. I was invited to sing with Tom Paxton on their 1964 opening of a new factory. And there's a picture of me standing on the loading dock with a little dress and my slip showing. It's a very funny picture. So I saw a big program on PBS about Stephen Stills going to Martin and choosing all the woods and the string and everything else for his guitar that they would make. And I called Dick Boak and I said, Stephen's got a signature guitar. I want one. So he made me this new fabulous Judy Collins signature 12-string D40 based on the design of my earlier Martin that I played for years. So I guess the whole thing is sort of part of the story. It's a little bit like a fairy tale with me and Stephen, and we're lucky to be here to engage in this new exploration.
Stephen Stills and Judy Collins will be at Tanglewood in Lenox, Massachusetts on June 17th at 2:30 p.m. We spoke in September when the album Everybody Knows was released. Judy, congratulations on the new album and the tour, and thank you so much for taking this time for us.
My pleasure. Have a great day. Bye-bye, Ian.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
In winter and spring and summer, my memories will never go. I always dream of making a little home here. Now they've gone and done their very best. Clear out the trees and the Queen Anne's lace and the birds with their feathered nests. Nothing out here in the old days, nothing but a river.